Welcome to Question Time live from Online Educa Berlin. Online Educa is probably the world's largest e-learning conference. And this year there's something like 2,000 delegates here, and I heard from 97 countries. In case you're interested what countries they're coming from, I'm told that the most delegates come from the UK. The second, I think, is from the Netherlands. The third is Finland, and I think the fourth is Germany. But 97 countries here in all. And there's 2 days of rigorous and less rigorous debating, questioning, many keynotes, a huge exhibition hall, and a lot of social gathering. So we're very happy to be holding our second online question time from here in Berlin. We've got a studio audience today, and I'll be inviting them to ask their questions to the panel. But first, perhaps I should introduce to you our esteemed panel. First of all, we have Kirsten Winkler. Kirsten says, the mantra of EduQuest on the search for better education also defines Kirsten Winkler's other activities in the online education space, covering startups in online education since 2009, and having been a successful independent online teacher on various platforms and services herself, Kirsten knows both sides of the table. Today, Kirsten shares her in-depth knowledge of the education startup scene and experiences with founders, investors, and educators. And we've also got here Paul Glader. Paul Glader is editor of the blog wiredacademic.com. He's working on a book project about education innovation this year as a journalism fellow at Freie Universität in Berlin. He spent 10 years as a reporter on the Wall Street Journal, and he's also written for the Washington Post and Spiegel Online, fastcompany.com and other publications. Despite nerdy interests in digital learning, he also enjoys outdoor activities such as surfing and snowboarding. Well, there won't be much snowboarding this week in Berlin, but surfing may come in useful if the rain continues in the way it's falling now. Melanie Campbell is an engineer and works for Bowie BC in the construction trade. She gave me 3 reasons why she'd come to here today. One, because she could travel. Secondly, because I asked her to. And the third, Melanie, because I haven't got the piece of paper in front of me. What was it? It was a wonderful word you made up. What was your third reason?
Epistemophiliac.
Because she's an epistemophiliac. We had a debate, first of all, whether that was an English-speaking word, and secondly, if you'd be allowed to say it on the BBC. On to our fourth panellist today, Nick Kearney. Nick Kearney works for a company called
Andamio.
Andamio, he tells me, because I didn't know this, means scaffolding. So I suppose at least 2 of our delegates here today have some constructive link between them. Okay, welcome panel, and we're going to take the first question. And the next first question comes from Carsten, and I'm going to ask him to read his question to the panel. Panel, listen carefully.
Okay, yeah, thank you. I'm Carsten from Shanghai Jiaotong University. My question is, will there still be universities in 10 years' time? And if so, what will they look like? Very simple question.
Will there still be universities in 10 years' time? And if so, what will they look like? Paul, your take on that.
Yes. In a word, yes. There will still be universities, in my opinion, at that time. I think one of my main opinions right now is that the online education revolution, which it is, I think, a revolution, is its very early stages. In the baseball, we might say first inning, in my opinion, or we can debate this more later. But okay, so the second part of your question, what do universities look like in 10 years? My opinion is that we maybe have fewer universities. There may be a winnowing out process of universities in, say, the U.S., and universities will have to, in my mind, identify niche. Now, the elite universities already have their niche. Regional universities maybe have a niche, but even, you know, I'll take my home state of South Dakota in the U.S. We have 700 or 800,000 people, very small populated state with five state universities and several private universities on top of that. And when I think about our state universities, we've got a mining and tech university. That should remain. It's a historic, you know, mining area in the west side of South Dakota. There's an ag school. That should remain, liberal arts school. But in my opinion, I think five is too many. I think we will see a winnowing out of universities, a specialization of universities, and universities will be much more blended. Students, maybe more students will be studying from a distance for a university. Some may be living on campus and studying in their dorm rooms with video. I think they will look quite, universities will look much, much radically different than they do today, but they'll still be there.
Thank you. And Kirsten, do you agree?
I would probably just continue answering this as I think this morning I heard a number that already today, in some states at least, only about 20% of students are actually still learning on campus. Although I think there will always be some people who prefer campus, just the campus experience, to the various other forms of learning. And I mean, Paul already started. We are definitely seeing this shifting towards online learning, then a lot of video lectures, which is asynchronous content. So I think the role at what point the professor actually comes in is somewhat shifting from, the sage on the stage to much more, I think in Sir Michael Barber's opening plenary was the self-responsibility, so that every learner today has to take self-responsibility not only for his learning but also for his career. And I think we are going to see traditional higher education more sort of merge into something broader, defining what is learning. I am thinking of that in 10 years of time, probably everybody will sort of have something like a learning graph or knowledge graph, where sort of all sorts or points of his learning are being shown, like we have our social graph already today. And somewhat that we will not think of a classic 2-year or 5-year degree, but see this as a career of lifelong learning, and higher education is just one point on this much longer graph.
Nick, are we still going to have universities? Is there enough money in Spain to run universities anymore?
I wonder. It seems to me that there are three functions of a university. One is research. Interesting, a lot of professors seem to put that first. Here at Educa, we talk about the second function, which is learning. And the third function is certification. And however much the research may get farmed out into institutes and units and so on, and learning may change because of all these things that are happening, which colleagues have already talked about, I think there is an issue in relation to certification, and that it's going to take generations for employers and society to stop seeing a university qualification as a special thing that differentiates people from other people, and that therefore that function and that role is something that they will be able to continue to play. Whether we feel that's a good idea or not is a different debate, but I think they'll still be here doing that because they have such a well-consolidated position in the minds of people as validators and certifiers of learning.
Melanie, your view.
Well, I personally can only reflect on construction. So engineers nowadays, I mean, there's a big discussion in construction industry about how practical or work-related are studies still. And the industry needs people who are close to the job and who are not only learning theoretically. So basically, the certification itself is becoming less important, also within the big discussion of bachelor or master or engineer, whatever. The employer wants to know what is a person capable of doing, and they don't look for the type of qualification you have.
So we've basically got three people in favour of saying universities are going to continue, but the one person perhaps from the industry here is less dubious. Karsten, you asked the original question. What's your view?
I certainly agree that there will still be universities in 10 years' time, especially as Nick said, from the research point of view, but I also agree with Kirsten that the way that there's only one single certificate that we have that prove our learning, this will disappear. We will have badges, LinkedIn profiles, and whatever, contributions on websites and so on. And I think employees will look at these things when they decide to hire people. And I think this addresses what Melanie says, that there will be a trace that tells the companies that these guys, they not just have learned something, but they also know how to apply it.
Okay, thanks very much for your question. And for those of you listening on the internet radio live, if you want to ask a question to our panel, you can join in. Those of you who have got me on their Skype list, which my Skype name is Graham Atwell, just Skype me because I'm live on Skype now, or you can try asking your questions via Twitter using the hashtag #OEB12QT. I'll say that again, #OEB12QT, and I'll be watching for that hashtag on Twitter. Feel free to ask your questions over the internet because we are in a connected world here. Okay, let's move to a second question, and I'm not quite sure the name of the questioner here, but if you could take the microphone for the man with the red tie. Okay, Mandrata, if you could please give us your name, sir.
Thank you. Crispin Weston from Soltis in the UK. The first session I went to this morning was by Donald Clark from the University for Industry, and he said in his experience of delivering online courses, they weren't cheaper than face-to-face courses because of the need for intensive tutoring or one-to-one. In my second session, it was MOOCs examined, when the speakers all predicted that MOOCs would transform higher education. And yet they admitted that MOOCs did not yet have any established business model, and the experience of early courses, only 10% of starters finished the courses. Are MOOCs a bubble?
Are MOOCs a bubble? Massive open online courses. And I was talking yesterday about this program with Nick Kearney, and he said, oh my God, I hope there's no questions about MOOCs. So, Nick, your view on that question?
Well, I think the concept of the MOOC has been hijacked by the e-learning industry, so to speak, and the large universities. The original CMOOC was an interesting experimental sort of, it's the last station on the line towards totally informal self-organized learning. And that model was a very interesting model. I've participated in several and found it useful, interesting, although I would say that in certain respects, life is a MOOC. You know, you organize your own learning, you go and find resources, you join different discussion groups and so on, and the MOOC itself, the CMOOC, is only slightly more organized than that. The other MOOCs, which the people who invented CMOOCs call ex-MOOCs because they're not sure what they are, I think are clearly becoming a sort of hyperspace drive back 10 years. They're basically e-learning as we started to do it 10 years ago, but with a lot more people enrolled. And the attrition rates I think they're absolutely what should be expected with the degree of support that's being provided. And so I think that we are in a kind of a hype phase where everybody wants to do a MOOC, but all the research that's been done on MOOCs indicates that they are useful for fairly mature self-organized people who know about how they learn, know how they learn best, and are capable of navigating the fairly solitary experience in terms of the organization you have to do on their own. And it was interesting, and a few weeks ago I was evaluating projects, and we all agreed about somebody had decided that they were going to, with initial teachers under initial teacher training, they were going to use a MOOC. And we just thought, that's an incredible, ridiculous proposition, because without the kind of support and the scaffolding that people need to start out in a particular field, they're going to be lost and they will fail and they will drop out. And so I'm really not sure that, I mean, the MOOC is an interesting idea, especially in its original form, but I'm not sure that what's going on now, the Coursera edX stuff, is much more than new skin for the old ceremony. And so I think bubble is quite an interesting and useful word to think about there.
Melanie, MOOCs in the construction trade, do you think this will ever happen?
Well, I don't really think so, because I was asking myself the question, how long can we learn by ourselves? Because if you look at construction industry, we are all in a team, working in a team on the construction side. And what motivates us to learn, what motivates us to better ourselves, it's actually the result, the feedback. What we construct is our positive feedback. So if we don't have the team for positive feedback that motivates us to learn more, I don't think it can go on and go on. As there is a certain restriction to it, because the feedback of the people is missing. And so therefore, I think it wouldn't work for construction.
And Kirsten, you've been writing about MOOCs, I guess, on your online blog. What's your take on it all?
So I think there are two factors contributing to the hype. One is that these are startups, which means they have investment. And particularly Silicon Valley discovered higher education and specifically MOOCs as an interesting space to invest in. And the other thing is us, the tech press, and maybe also EdTech press, who sort of made Coursera and to some extent Udacity their darlings and love to write about them. I mean, if we look at it, the way of delivering content is pretty traditional. So these are video lecture platforms with some bells and whistles to them, a little bit of social features, but nothing really revolutionary. So from all of the MOOCs, the one I personally find more interesting is probably Udacity. Just from the founder background of Sebastian Troon, somebody so involved in Google, in the self-driving car project, machine learning, this is something I would actually expect from MOOCs to elaborate on, how to implement machine learning into this and what would actually we can get out as data, then connected to adaptiveness, so adaptive learning and so on. So I don't want to throw out too many of the hype words, but I think machine learning is definitely one of the more interesting topics for me personally, and goes, of course, way beyond this rather traditional thing of a MOOC or video lecture platform for me.
And what's your take on this? Is it true that the press is just hyping this?
Well, you know what's interesting is that I think MOOCs, the emergence of MOOCs, is one of the first times that I've seen the mainstream media really pick up on online learning trends, which is interesting. Maybe that contributes to this, we're going to call it a bubble. And maybe the question about the bubble is the bubble going to pop if it is a bubble? And if I was a weatherman, I might put the odds at 65% that MOOCs will survive a bubble, and 35% that they won't. And I think Kirsten alluded to a good, I think the real economics of it, as we learned in a session at the conference today, the schools involved, it's a huge time commitment and a huge money commitment. For even if it's a brand building exercise for Princeton or Stanford, you know, these schools are paying $500,000. I think University of Texas is paying $5 million to be part of it. And so the question is, how long will they sustain that investment? And what kind of return are they expecting? And as Kirsten alluded, for the venture capitalists, I mean, what's the typical time period? It's about 3 years. They want to see some kind of growth or payoff. So I think that's the economics and the equation we're watching. And if it is a 3 years time, I think already what's interesting is you've got big players, big names involved this time. And certainly this was tried 10 years ago, right, with Columbia University had tried some form of MOOC, but and a consortium of schools. But I think this time it feels different, perhaps, because of Stanford, because of some of the names, Sebastian Thrun, the people involved. And even if one of the edX doesn't find a path to profitability or Coursera, it seems like this is evolving so quickly that we're seeing hybrid models. For example, Semester Online this week or so ago from a company called 2U, formerly Tutor. They announced a consortium of, I think, 10 schools that are charging students. Anyone can sign up for a class from, you know, Notre Dame, Northwestern, other schools in this consortium that you pay for, and you receive credit. Well, that's a clear business model, it seems like, where one could make, these schools could have payoff. So I think we're going to keep seeing these new business models. There may be some winners and losers, but I think it will play out that MOOC somehow will be successful. We might see some failures and successes along the way, but I think that they will survive.
I'm going to throw this out to the audience. Does anyone here have a strong view about MOOCs? Pros or cons, or are you all just as puzzled? Okay, back to the original questioner. What was your take on Donald Clark's presentation? Well,
thanks. I mean, I agree very much with a lot of what's been said at the panel. So, I suspect that they are a bubble, but I suspect that bubbles burst and actually have a sort of aftermath and are actually helpful. So I think things will come out of it. And I think universities as a brand maybe is something commercially that may come out of it. And I very much agree also with Kirsten about it seems to me that pedagogy is not yet in place. There was some interesting talk about peer review and peer-to-peer networks, and that's one way of scaling it, but there are dangers in that as well. I think ultimately you need more machine-driven, you need intelligence tutoring systems, you need all that stuff, and I don't think the software's there, so I think it's a bit premature. I very much agree with what people said about this as being a sort of rather regressive pedagogy, that you're falling back on a very transmissive form of education because you don't have that conversational feedback, which... And I'm a little bit sceptical about all the fashion about informal learning because, I mean, I think that suits the mature learner. But the purpose of formal education is to get someone up to that point where they can be the mature learner. And I think it's a bit... I don't think we can apply informal learning pedagogies often to formal education. So, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you for your question. I'm going to take a question now from Jenny Hughes. What's your question, Jen?
Wrong glasses. Oh, the world's divided between those that hate Facebook and those that love it. I want to know which side of the fence the panel is on, and more importantly, what do you think of the people who sit on the other side of it? Go on, your sneaky, secret suspicions about what you think about the people who are on the opposite side.
I don't think I'm going to be able to resist as a chair making my comments on this at some point. But anyway, are you on the panel Facebook lovers or Facebook haters? And what panel do you think of the people on the other side of the debate? I'll start down there. Melanie, have you got a Facebook account and do you love it?
No. I am a little bit, at the moment, I'm a little hater of Facebook. Because all kind of friends try to drag me in there and I don't really feel comfortable. Why? Well, when I see other communities on Facebook, because my partner is on Facebook and he's using it a lot, and they are really revealing their whole life, their complete history from childhood till whatever, retirement. And I think it's so, I can't even describe it. I don't want to publish myself like that. And that's why I'm really, I don't like it. And but I have always people around me who try to drag me in. So I don't know how long I can resist, but I'm still resisting at the moment. Thank you.
A Facebook resister. Nick, are you a Facebook resister?
You still love him, right?
I spoke about Facebook this morning in a session. I got off Facebook about 2.5 years ago and then got straight back on it with a different name. Because part of my job is, one of the things I do is evaluate projects, and sometimes you need to look at their Facebook group without necessarily using your own name, because anonymity is necessary. So I'm one of the sneaky ones there. In fact, because I got used to using that profile, I do use it in projects, and this morning I talked about 3 projects where we'd use Facebook in education, and I talked about the difficulties that that arise with that. Personally, I don't think I agree with the idea that you can hate it or love it. I think Facebook is, I don't hate it, but I'm very concerned by it. There's a very interesting article by somebody, by a group, the main author is called Pepe. It's called The Pirandellian Identity Myth in Facebook. It's not myth, it's the dilemma. And he draws very interesting, sets a very interesting little conspiracy theory about Facebook. A bloke called Peter Thiel, who's a venture capitalist and one of the largest investors in Facebook at the start, and part of the way Facebook was constructed was due to him. He wrote a very interesting book called The Diversity Myth, where he expounds a vision of the world which is against diversity. He feels that the world should be more homogeneous, more similar, and that we should all be the same. When I look at the Facebook profile page, I think you see that agenda put into practice. How many options do you have for expressing your political views on the Facebook profile page? Have a look at it. 3, right? It's one, the other, or not sure, you know? And I think that there is a problem there with a sort of warm fuzz, a sort of lack of space for anything beyond phatic communication, shall we say. A kind of, hi, how are you? I'm good. Are you good? I'm good. We're all good. We're all happy here. And that's fine. And it was very interesting this morning when I said, could you all talk about the last message you posted on Facebook? It was amazing, the noise. Like, sometimes you ask a group in a talk to talk to your neighbour about something. I've never seen anything like it. It was just like everybody was chattering away, and it was really almost impossible to stop them. They were so interested in what they had posted on Facebook, and it's quite clear that there is a driver there. People like it. They really love to be on it, and as you were saying, that and as the question says, they really get into it if they get into it. But I have my doubts about whether it's a useful or shall we say, productive thing for society to be using. But we shall see.
Kirsten, I suppose you've got a Facebook account.
Various, so.
So she's a sneaky one as well.
I am. So I work as a blogger and interviewer, and in my world, it would somehow be weird if I'm not on the various social networks. So you might say the same for Twitter. I know people adding 30,000 people they follow, and I think you have a lot of noise there as well. So if you check out my Facebook profile, you will, of course, find the private Kirsten Winkler. But you cannot even message me, as I control my privacy and my private Facebook account like very strictly. But you will find my fan page, of course, or the fan page of my work. So there's various ways for really people people really interested in getting in touch with me. And I think that's probably the broader question. How do people value their data? I mean, if we think of Google, other companies, there are not only million, but billion-dollar companies built on data. And I think in our society, many people give a lot of data because they get something for free, a little service. And, well, if somebody said, it's not from me, but if there's no price tag to it, you're the product. So you're always paying with something. And in this case, you're paying with your data. Facebook, Google, also Twitter, they learn about us constantly through our actions, tweets, updates, photos, and so on. So what I do is basically I control what I put out there and what messages I want to put out there. You have all kinds of controls also in Facebook, although I would agree that their communication is pretty bad, but you can make a post custom, so only visible to a limited number of people or to your friends or worldwide, so public. So I think there are means to control this, but we as users have to be sensitive about this and have to see that our data is really probably one of the most valuable things on the internet or out there. And I think an education about this and more responsibility would be appropriate for many people.
And Paul, you're on Facebook, I guess?
Yes, I am. And the question reminds me of this Ovid, the love poet, who said, I love, but I hate, yet I hate. And it's, I think we all have this love, many of us have a love-hate relationship with Facebook. And if I had to pick one side or the other, I guess I'd pick I do love it. And for the same reasons Kirsten mentioned, as a journalist, you have to be on there. And it's also fascinating to just the information you pick up about your friends, your family, a way to stay in touch. And on one side, I think we're seeing as time goes on, okay, we've got the privacy concerns. We have this. This is an interesting point on the diversity myth. I think some of us learn to have almost a dual personality, not a dual personality, perhaps, where there's like a Facebook personality and your real personality. It's like a Christmas letter or something that's out there. My wife is not on Facebook, so she's one of these resistors, and it's phenomenal to see how at times, as we go along with social networks, some of these resistors end up feeling, by the way, I admire them. If we're asking how do I feel about the people on the other side of the fence, I admire them because it's Melanie and people who are resisting because it's a bold statement. But I wonder for Melanie if there's times where you want to sign into a website and now you have to sign into your Facebook. Like I think Etsy, my wife was using it the other day, and she couldn't do something on Etsy because she didn't have a Facebook profile. So it's becoming more and more entrenched.
Is it a problem, man?
It's not really a problem because I have an alias through my job, but I'm not using it as yet. But it's there, so if I need to, I could use it
to infiltrate.
Yes. Yeah, but there was no use of it as yet, and
so we're seeing. Well, I'll just end on that note that on one side of the continuum, we're seeing the resistors who are. It's like riding in a horse and buggy on the Autobahn by not being on Facebook at times, and then on the other side, there's Facebook addicts, where I've seen several posts from people who said, especially young people, who say, I can't stop checking this thing, and I need to get away and have my own life back, or end up with strange social dynamics, going through a breakup publicly or something on Facebook, and there's this other human side that's fascinating, and a reason that some might hate it.
It's interesting what you say about links, because it is all about convenience.
Yeah.
Absolutely, Facebook Connect or Twitter Connect.
Abandoning critical thinking for convenience.
Absolutely.
So, how will we summarise in the panel, I guess? That was pretty ambivalent from most people here, wasn't it? Jenny, how many accounts do you have on Facebook?
Which one of me? Well, some of me has quite a number of accounts, but that's another story, it's about identities. I mean, I love Facebook. I use an awful lot for teaching and learning and with working with kids. I love using it socially. What do I think about the opposition? I think on the whole, they're a bit mealy-mouthed. I think they're being a bit grown up about this. I always get a bit scared by people who say, I don't do Facebook, because I'm thinking that's really grown up. And I get really bored of all the techie people telling me it's a security risk and I should do this and I should do that. Dirk? Yeah, you'd say that's me. And then, Graham, you clutter up my Facebook, because the only things that you ever send me, I'm going to unfriend you, because you just clutter up my cosy little social environment with a whole load of rubbish about work. So I'm going to unfriend you immediately, because I can't cope with this. You know, I want to talk about the Archers and about who's going to the rugby on Saturday, not about whatever you want me to talk about.
So, yes, yeah. And I did say I'd reveal my position. My position is that my Facebook is just a stream of personal goings-on, personal stuff, which may be of some passing interest to dip into and out of, but as a stream, it's just the trivial, everyday, living stream of what people are doing, which I'm not sure, which, whilst I love sitting in the pub about it, I'm not sure that I want to sit on a computer and read a stream of everyday goings on. But this debate will probably come up next year at Online Educa and probably come up the year after, and we'll see where we go about it. So, from Facebook lovers and Facebook haters to quite a hard question. Online Educa this year probably takes place against the backdrop of the highest youth unemployment in Europe, probably since the 1930s and possibly higher. Yet we don't hear a lot of talk about those unemployed people at Online Educa, which is full of very shiny stands and nice products. And so I've got a question coming in possibly over the internet and possibly appropriately from Valencia in Spain, which is one of the regions in Europe worst hit by youth unemployment, from Ana García Munoz, who asks, can people use social networks and develop communities of practice online with really high unemployment rates and no hope of jobs? Is it enough to say, get involved in social networks in that situation? Technology, high unemployment, social networks. Paul?
It can't hurt, especially, but I guess it depends what social network we're talking about. I mean, obviously, for professional situations, I would think of LinkedIn, not Facebook, as a way to look for jobs, particularly if you're from Spain or Greece or another hard-hit country, and you've got a particular skill, if you're an architect or an engineer, and you can't find jobs locally. Maybe there's a company with your that needs your specialty somewhere else. And so it seems, LinkedIn would be maybe there's some other social networks as well that would be a good way to find a job in another place or to work remotely. And I would think, you know, this is again back to the MOOC question. I know everybody hates that word, but this is to me the potential power of MOOCs is that, if there's a computer programmer in a place where there's not many jobs, for someone who knows Drupal or Ruby on Rails or whatever language or whatnot, now there's a way for a person to learn these skills, and find a job in a way that they didn't have that potential in the future. So I think, I think all the things we're talking about here at this conference are potentially very helpful to places in the world that have high unemployment. And I know that the EU Commission with the Erasmus program, this is one of their intentions, was to help mobility within Europe and in the labor market. And they're spending more money to expand Erasmus, which is sends students from one country to another country to study within Europe. And I think that they're also thinking of introducing MOOC courses or online courses in some way. We had a story on my site about that several months ago. My view is that there's some potential answers here for this problem.
Kirsten?
I have a practical example, actually. So in your introduction, Graham, you mentioned that at some point in my career I worked as an independent language tutor online, and at the same time, so now for the past 4 years, I have been creating online videos to teach people German, and this was the original intention was to give it for free to existing students so that they can learn something when we don't have lessons, so that they have some asynchronous content and then the live lessons with me. What happened? I put them on YouTube because at that time and still today, I mean, it was the biggest platform, and I found out that somebody named Salman Khan had very much the same idea, just more for science stuff, so that was actually funny to see. And well, obviously, people who were not at all connected with me watched my videos, gave me feedback, and I started a Facebook page and group, and so more and more people joined, and now I regularly get messages from people in Spain who maybe paid for a language course in an institution or not at all because they couldn't afford it anymore, but who took all available resources on the internet for free and sort of brushed up their German or learned in order to find a job here in Germany because, many Spanish people think Germany is still, although there are, some signs of crisis, but compared with other countries in Europe, undoubtedly Germany is still going strong and German economy and so on. So, definitely in the hope of finding work here in Germany or at least getting connected with German world of employment in general. And, this is sort of my little example how this worked through social networks.
So, social networks. Nick, you come from Valencia.
Saludos, Ana.
Is social networking the answer? And what's really happening with the unemployment?
Well, the thing we always forget, perhaps, when we talk about unemployment is how hard it is to be unemployed and how lonely it can be to be unemployed. And I think that from that perspective, just participating in social activity on social networks is obviously a very useful source of support, and there are support groups I know that work together to look for ways of finding a way out of the dead end, I guess, that you feel you're in when you're unemployed. I think that obviously doing a MOOC, joining any kind of community of practice and getting involved in activity is obviously likely to provide more opportunities than not doing it, so to speak, although I'm not entirely convinced that simply participating in some kind of activity is automatically going to solve the problem. It's quite clear that the kind of activity that you have on social media is very often serendipitous, in the sense that you find contacts, you make friends, and things you would never have expected to happen, contacts you'd never have expected to make pop up, and things happen. But from there to finding a job, there isn't necessarily an easy path, but it's worth. I think it's worth doing.
Okay, and I suppose unemployment isn't such a big problem in Germany at the moment.
We more have a problem finding people for the branch, for the sector. So actually, I'm very curious about first trainees, for instance, coming from Spain or Greece, working on the construction sector now. We have a couple of requests that they should practice in companies, but those are mainly people who have basic knowledge in language in German already. But what I noticed on the whole is that people who use social networks a lot are those who are migrating already, who are moving around a lot. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think it helps, it supports mobility a lot. And it makes people feel still home no matter where they are. And therefore, I think social networking is very important.
Okay, Anna says, hi for Nick. Obviously, you're answer went down well with her, and she says she is herself unemployed and is doing a MOOC on open data. So it's happening, this sort of thing, obviously.
Suerte con ello.
I think we've just got space for one more question before we're coming to an end. And I'm going to have a question that I got handed in earlier while I was in, whilst we were in this morning's radio programme, from someone who can't actually come, unfortunately, live to the session. But it's a question that interested me a lot. There's been a lot, they said, at this conference about video on demand being the future of learning. And certainly walking around the exhibition stands here, about a third of them seem to be about video this year. It is quite striking. Anyway, the question was, if members of the panel could star in their own video, what would they like to be an expert about, or rather, what do they wish to be an expert about? If you could make a video about anything with you as a star, what would you like to be an expert on? Nick, what would you like to be an expert on your own video?
I think I'd make a video about how a talking head on a video isn't necessarily the best way to go about teaching and learning. But if I were to take you up on that, then I think I'd make one on poetry. Because that I like poetry, I'm interested in poetry, I have a lot to say about poetry, and I think it could be quite an interesting video, though I say it myself.
And, of course, what members of the panel probably don't know is I've got a video crew just waiting outside to come in here after. Anyway, Melanie, if you were going to make a video, and maybe we will be making a video with you soon, what would you like to be an expert in?
Oh, well, for me, it's very striking to see how young people use videos and produce videos. And I think if I would make a video, I would explore how they use videos, because they use it for everything, and it's very, very interesting to see what they use it for, and I think we adults can learn from them a lot.
Paul, you're going to be a video star?
Well, as much as I would like to do a channel about surfing, I'm not so good at it, and B, I think you get a lot of salt in the camera. So, salt water. So, I would say I'm a new father, and with a child, you know, I think it's there's a lot of. I've seen some videos that are very good that give you tips as a parent on some things, how to calm a baby or whatnot. But I think there's a lot more room for that kind of video, instructive, you know, ideas on childcare, on entertaining or teaching your early childhood learning, that kind of stuff. So, I think I'd want to be a super dad. Video, Sal Khan.
We've got a poet, we've got a video maker about video making, a super dad, and Kirsten, what's yours going to add to this collection of videos?
Paul, maybe a surfer in Second Life or another virtual environment. So perfect. That was my thought. Well, as my previous answer suggested, I'm doing a ton of video, online video actually. But of course, in my interviews, my interviewees or their product are the stars, and in my German videos is more about the content. So what I would probably like to, and it's maybe not totally unrealistic, is a cooking show. So cooking videos.
And what would you be cooking?
All sorts of cuisine. So.
So we've got cooking, we've got super dad.
Oh, I want to change.
What do you want to change, Nick?
I'm going to make a video about how to hold a baby at 3 in the morning and rock back and forth, especially football.
It's perfect, I need that.
Well, okay, that's all we've got time for. Sadly, that's the end of this programme. I'd like to thank Online Educative Berlin for giving us the chance to make this radio show. I'd like to thank the members of the audience for coming along and participating and asking their questions. And of course, I'd like to thank our panel, who have done a wonderful job. And thanks to all the listeners. Thanks to Anna for participating at a distance. And we hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. And for those of you listening live on the radio, we'll be back, of course, with the second of our conference special editions of Sounds of the Bazaar, tomorrow at 11 o'clock CET, where we'll be broadcasting from the Marlene Bar at the conference. Thank you all. Good night from Berlin.